36 of the Improvised Music Agenda podcast. Our guest this week is Kath Roberts. Let's have a listen. Thanks everyone for picking this podcast and listening today. How are we all doing?
All good.
Right, so this is the first of the live podcasts that I've recorded. So, yeah, so today as I'm recording this intro is the 23rd of November, which is a Saturday morning. I did one on, well, I did this episode on the 18th of November. So, yeah, it's pretty fresh. It's the quickest turnaround yet, I think. If I get it out today, that is. Anyway, so our guest, Kath Roberts, probably a lot of you would know her, but in case you don't, she plays the baritone saxophone, and yeah, she's in many groups, one of which is who you heard up top there, her group Sloth Racket. And yeah, so Kath makes loads of interesting music and killer bands and everything, and yeah, and she was part of the whole Loom collective, and also she makes her own records as well, like actually makes the sleeves and everything. But we get into all that in the interview. Yeah, so before we carry on with the interview, if you're enjoying the podcast, do please give it a like or a subscribe or a nice review on iTunes or wherever you listen to your podcasts. And if you really like it, you can donate some money via the Patreon. And yeah, every little helps. That all goes towards podcast maintenance costs and everything. And there'll be another live podcast on, well, tomorrow, the 24th of November, so the last day of the London Jazz Festival, and I'll be interviewing Mark Holub, of Leadbib, after their show at the Rio in Dalston. And then I'll be interviewing Ruth Goller, and her interview's just before her gig upstairs, the Vortex. So if you're around tomorrow afternoon or evening, between 6 and 8 p.m. downstairs, the Vortex, we'll be recording another one of these episodes. But before then, if you happen to be around this afternoon, 23rd of November, and hear this in time and got the afternoon off, you can go and see Kath play at the Barbican Free Stage at 5 p.m. Yeah, so that will be a double bill also with Dima. So yeah, that is with D Byrne, who is the first ever guest on the podcast. So do please go and check that out if you're around town. But anyway, less of my waffle, let's hear our conversation with Kath Roberts. This is the first ever live podcast, and thank you all for coming down and checking it out. Yeah, so it's here downstairs at the Vortex, which is the spiritual home of all this music. And yeah, so I'm very excited to do it here, which, yeah, it's a very good place to do it. Anyway, so the guest I have this evening is Kath Roberts. Let's give a hand. Great. How are you
thanks.
Doing, Kath?
I'm good, thanks. Thanks cool. for having me, Hugh.
That's all right. Pleasure, yeah. I'm glad we found a time.
Yeah, for sure.
After countless email
it's a long
exchanges and many things in the way, I don't know. Yeah, busyness. It's all good. Cool. So I'm trying to think a good place to start. So you grew up in the Midlands, did you?
That's right, yeah, Northamptonshire.
Oh, great. Cool. Yeah. And then, so yeah, so when did music come into your life? Was it?
I think it came into my life when I was a really small kid, actually. Apparently, I asked to play saxophone at about the age of 9, and that's when I started the instrument. And I think my parents sort of said, wouldn't you prefer clarinet or flute, you know, something a bit smaller? And I was like, no, saxophone. And I don't remember that or why that was.
Right, yeah, yeah.
But that's how it happened.
But do you remember your first saxophone?
Yeah, I think I do, actually, yeah.
All right, what was it? Was it alto?
It was an alto.
Okay.
It was an Earlham. Just a beginner sax, yeah. It was, I don't know, I mean, I don't remember it in detail. But, yeah, alto was where I started.
So, yeah, because I guess the baritone, because, yeah, while doing the research, that became a thing later on. did
That's right, yeah.
So was that an intentional thing to get the baritone, or did it just kind of, was it an organic?
It just sort of thing? Happened, yeah, because I always played alto from a kid all the way through, and baritone. I bought one because I was saxophone shopping with my partner, Tom, who's a sax player, and we were there because he wanted to buy a baritone. And I was just there kicking my heels, you know, in a room full of saxophones. So I started playing Barry's and I found a horn and I thought, oh no, I love this horn. I'm going to have to buy it. And it was a cheap one, luckily. So I did that. And then I played it mainly at first on kind of random function gigs or things like that. But right. I was still mainly doing alto. But gradually over time, that baritone took over, and now it's my main thing. But I don't know really how it's happened.
All right. Well, that's cool though. That's great. Yeah. But what was it? Was it the sound of the tumba that attracted you to it? Or was it... Because I guess if it wasn't a thing that you thought of before, was it just that feeling of...
Yeah, I guess it was the feeling of playing it. And I feel comfortable in that area of the music, you know. I feel comfortable down low. Maybe I should be a bass player, actually. You know?
Yeah.
But I realised I was much more comfortable there rather than being on the top of a band as an alto player, you know. Because on baritone you can play bass lines, and I mean you can do that on any instrument, right? But on Barry you can really
get
into that
really
if you want. Yeah. So
mega. So if we rewind a little bit to earlier on in music. So like what were the things that you were listening to when you first started being serious?
About music. Oh God. I mean, I don't know. Like, I think the things I was listening to were not necessarily related to saxophone or to jazz. So
okay.
When I was a teenager, I was into a lot of rock and metal.
Oh,
I was
great.
Going to the rock club and
What bands
you know,
are
all
into?
That kind of thing. I was into like Rage Against the Machine,
yes.
System of a Down, and all, you know, this kind of music. The music that was being played in a rock club in Kettering. Because that's the only music that we heard, right? So that was my like music listening world. And then I was doing saxophone in a kind of like jazz education-y sort of world of like county big bands. And then some classical stuff at school, because there wasn't any jazz at the school, but there was really good classical music stuff. And so the two things weren't really related, actually.
Oh, right,
in that way, you know, it wasn't like, I heard Charlie Parker or something, and then that inspired... Although I did hear that music a little bit, but it wasn't in my listening
totally,
world like that.
Because I got feeling I'm from a similar background. Because
I
tell you where it all like properly changed for me. Which I've probably mentioned in previous podcasts, but Mr. Bungle.
Oh, yeah, really.
So we were into them.
I've not been heavily into them, but they've been a band that I've been aware of for a long time and thought I must check them out in more detail. I've got like one album.
But I guess with that music sort of marries that whole, I don't know, it's like that kind of crazy metal kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of energy was all pretty manic, but But then the whole jazz thing as well.
Yep.
So I think I'm sure that's the first time I heard a walking bass line.
Oh, really? It was in
and
Mr.
I was
Bungle.
Like, I was like, what do you call that when the bass goes dum 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 dum?
And the next thing you know.
Exactly, yeah. It's all gone wrong, isn't it?
Fast forward to now.
But
Pixies as well was a massive band for me. And Breeders.
Breeders and stuff. I've not checked that out much, but when were they around?
They were around in like the late 80s into the 90s. And actually, the Pixies are current. Like, they are back. I think they're playing now. But I'm not really aware of what they're doing.
Right,
you know,
they
think they kind of reformed.
Right,
but
yeah.
But I haven't really followed any of the new stuff. Not for any reason as well, but...
Oh, right, yeah. But I mean,
I'm just stuck on, like, specific albums from a time. And that's...
Okay. Like,
you know, with that band. And that's kind of...
Right, yeah, yeah.
That's all they need.
But yeah, I find it funny with like all that music is kind of so much to check out. Like, with Radiohead, I didn't check that out until like, I don't know, 3-4 years ago.
Oh, really?
So I kind of managed to like miss the whole thing. It's like, when you're kind of in such a jazz head kind of thing.
I was heavily into Radiohead at one time from kind of like, all the way through to Amnesiac, basically. From the Benz, from Pablo Honey.
Yeah.
Through to Amnesiac. But then after that album, and again, I don't know what the reason was, I sort of stopped following that band. And so I've got tons of Radiohead albums later than that I haven't heard.
Right.
And then every now and again, I'm talking to someone and they go, oh, blah, 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 blah. And I think, oh, what album's that? And it's always from one from the. Because Amnesiac is a long time ago, right? This is like 2002 or something like that.
That's right. Is that the one? Oh, no, maybe it's Kid A, but you know, Mark Lockhart?
he's on that, isn't
oh,
he?
Oh yeah. And there's like the jazz. Yeah, the jazz bit. That's Amnesia. I think it's both because it's the same session. Those two albums.
Was it Humphrey Littleton?
Littleton's on it. Yeah,
I find that hilarious. Yeah, that's so hip.
Yeah,
it's kind of.
Yeah.
It's like where you get all these old school jazzers on like mental music.
Exactly.
It's great. But great. So yeah, with that kind of age. So did you go on to study music at college, or was it?
Not at first, no. My undergraduate is actually in English literature.
Oh, cool.
I can't even say the word now.
Way more useful as a skill.
Yeah. And creative writing. So was down a whole lot, doing a whole other thing at that time, you know, thinking about, I'm going to be a writer or something. I mean, I don't really remember now. But, English lit.
And was the saxophone still kind of present?
Saxophone was still present, because I went to Warwick Uni and there's no music degree there, but there's a lot of music happening and there's a strong scene of like all different bands, orchestras. There's a music department basically, but it's not doing degrees.
Okay.
So you can join, a big band, which is what I was in. There's a brass band, I think there are orchestras, there's all kinds of things. So the whole time I was there, I was playing in a big band, which was like a non-audition thing, anyone could go along. But it also did gigs regularly. I was running a jam, and I was doing functions as well around the uni. So that all that stuff was there, but no one was studying music formally.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, brilliant. So, all right. So what, where was it to next after that?
After that, then I came down to London. That was 2005.
Oh, okay.
And that was to do a master's at Goldsmiths in cultural studies. So still not music. I was pursuing a certain area of stuff that I felt at that time, this is what I'm going into.
Brilliant.
I was still playing, mainly at that point function gigs. It was from that connection from people from the Warwick Uni scene who'd come down. They would be doing gigs around the place, so
Goldsmiths as well, there's a pretty strong kind of
there's a really strong music scene, but I did not interact with it,
didn't you?
Which is so weird to think that now, but I was there for 1 year and I didn't really meet or play with anyone from there. I don't know why that is, that's quite weird, and now I'm aware there's like an amazing scene there.
I know a bunch of people who went there, but maybe this was ages ago, maybe
But
didn't, what's his name, John Tilbury? He was a teacher
there,
wasn't he?
Yeah.
I think so. Anyway, right. I digress.
There's a lot of stuff happening at Goldsmiths, yeah.
Yeah, so, okay, so when you hit London, so that you were mainly an alto player then?
Yep, I was alto. Well, I think at that time I had alto and tenor, but tenor was just always a bit of a side horn, if it was needed, you know, like a doubling thing or whatever. And then... so after Goldsmiths, then I did part-time office jobs and more random gigging. And then at a certain point, I thought, I want to do some kind of college-level music, you know, and I think I should do that, you know, for some reason. So then I was in my late 20s, and I thought, okay, apply for the Guildhall postgrad.
All right, cool.
And that's what I did, actually. I had a year of... preparing myself for the Guildhall postgrad, but having not done any, you know, an undergrad of music or anything.
Oh, right, yeah, yeah.
Just random self-taught vibes.
That's cool. But
I did get in.
Great, yeah. And then, because I guess like a lot of those, like a lot of postgrad things, I guess not many people do the music thing beforehand, do they?
Yeah, that's probably true. It was quite a mix, yeah.
Yeah, but it's funny, actually, now that you say, like, with English Lit, I think, didn't George Crowley, he kind of...
He did that, yeah.
And then who else? Alex Hitchcock? I've got a feeling he did.
English people,
English,
yeah,
and then
funny.
Jazz.
Yeah,
anyway.
All
right, great. So was it 2000?
So that was in 2009.
2009, okay.
Because, there'd been a gap of, like, X years where I was just working random jobs and playing random music. In 2009 to 2011... I was doing the Guildhall postcard part-time and still working in office and still doing gigs. So that was an insane... Wow. Now I look at that time and think, I couldn't even do that now.
That's hardcore.
It's
that's
just work 24/7. But
great.
You know, but it was good. It was a good experience to meet all those musicians and visiting players and stuff like that, you know, to be in that environment.
Yeah.
So,
amazing. So, but at that time, so I guess you were kind of getting more into, like, jazz straight up kind of...
Yeah, sort of. Although, like, my main interest has always been in making my own music and composition. And at that time, it was not so much about doing free improvisation, which I've subsequently got really into. But at that time, it was more like I wanted to write my own, like, contemporary jazz stuff and, like, groove-based music and things like that. So I've never got heavily into straight ahead.
Okay.
It's been around me a lot, obviously, because I've been in that environment, but it hasn't been, like, my thing.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, cool. So who were the people that were influencing you at that time?
Around that time, I think it was, like, the sort of Jim Black sort of scene, cool. New York people. And actually, I think my favourite masterclass at Guildhall was when Tift came in. Do you know that trio?
Oh, yeah, Andrew D'Angelo, isn't it?
Yeah, and then Andrew D'Angelo and Jim Black. And that was a stunning masterclass. For me, that was, like, really up my street. I think some people were like, what is this?
Yeah, yeah.
But I absolutely adored that. Just the vibe of those people, the attitude, and the music was amazing. And Andrew D'Angelo's playing, I thought, was awesome.
Oh, yeah, he's
awesome.
Incredible, isn't he?
And I was transcribing him at Guildhall, which was insane, because super gestural playing and stuff sometimes.
Yeah.
And then trying to write down what he does was a bit nuts. But
Yeah,
so that was the kind of thing I was listening to and thinking about when I was there.
Great, yeah, yeah. Because, but that whole scene, though. But you know, I agree with you. It's like, those guys, that big impression with you. You know, especially, like, you know, Crispy, Jim Black, and, like, Tim Burn, bunch of his music.
Yeah, Tim Burn, definitely. Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, cool. So, but I guess, were you forming your own projects at that time?
So, not really while I was there, but when I finished. In fact, for my final recital, you have to put a band together. So, I did put something together, and I wrote maybe one or two pieces for that. And then after that, that became a band when I graduated, which was Septet Quadriceratops. And that was my first band.
Oh, great. Yeah.
So that was like 2011, 2012 that started.
Killer. Yeah. Yeah. And I guess you recorded that band, didn't you?
Yeah, we recorded. Yeah, yeah. So the band went from 2011 to about 2015 or 14. And it recorded an album and it released on FP. The Manchester label.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And then, so remind me, who's in that band?
Well, it had a shifting lineup, but who did we have? And it was big. Because it was hard to get, seven people together.
Yeah,
I don't know why that was my first band. Why didn't I do a trio?
Yeah.
So there was, the horns were me on alto and then Tom Ward on tenor sax and Magnus Dearness on trombone.
All right.
And on trumpet, we had a few people, actually. We had Dave Orchant. He was from my course at the time. He was a brilliant trumpet player. Henry Spencer was in it a little bit, and also Nick Walters was in it a bit. I think that's it on the trumpet. Oh, Chris Sneed as well. He was in it as well.
Oh, okay.
Also from my course.
Cool.
Because there were two trumpet players on the course at that time.
Right, yeah.
So that's trumpet. And then four horns. And then we had on keys, it was Kit Massey for a bit, and it was Dave O'Brien. And then Dave moved to bass. Oh, no, maybe the other way around. Dave was on bass, Kit was on keys, and then Kit left the band. And Dave moved to piano. That was useful. That was handy for me.
Yeah,
I was
yeah.
like, could someone just go on piano? So Dave went to piano, and then Jason Simpson came on bass. And on drums, we had a few different people. I had Luke Christie and Ollie Blackman. And then later, who else played drum? Maybe that's it. Maybe I only had two drummers.
Okay.
I think that's it, yeah.
Cool.
So it did morph over time, and obviously, sometimes not everyone's available for a gig.
Yeah,
when
yeah,
it's,
yeah.
Seven piece thing, so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mega. Then, so.
And it did one tour as well.
You managed to tour with seven people?
Yeah, I toured with seven
that's
people.
That's incredible.
Well, it was a massive tour, actually, because it was a Loom tour. Me and Dee organised for 2015. Loom on tour. So it was a double bill with my band, seven people, and then Entropy, five people.
Wow.
So a touring party of 12, and then we went round and we did about 9 dates.
Wow.
The UK.
That's hardcore. That's brilliant. Yeah.
It was a logistical roast.
Yeah, you can imagine.
But brilliant, brilliant to do that every night, double bill.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Wicked.
Killer.
Yeah.
Then, all right, so, but with where the music was at that point, because I guess, I suppose a lot of the music you're doing now, you're kind of, I guess, are you mostly playing improvised music?
Yeah.
Most of the gigs, but then. But you're still composing and stuff. But
yeah.
I guess back then the split would have been.
It would
more
have been
the composing.
Yeah, exactly. I didn't do any free playing until I don't know about 2013 or something.
Okay, yeah.
I was going to loads of gigs of that music and listening to a lot of it, but I hadn't done it.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
Or really known like what it was in terms of like how to play like in that way, whatever.
Right, yeah, yeah.
So, but then I did, I think well, the first time I played free might have been with Anton Hunter.
Oh, great.
Since I've collaborated with loads.
And that's the duo, was it Ripsaw Catfish?
Yeah, I think that might have been the first time I did free improvise. I don't know. But around that period that duo set up. Because when I had the idea for that band, it was not that what it has become. It was actually like a trio. I think it was like a rocky trio with drums. Okay. And then, so we had one play, and I, you know, it was like the beginning of a thing. But then actually we just kept it as a duo.
Mega.
And that's been like 6 years.
I mean, the practicality of that is way easier than seven people, right?
Just text one person and go, free. Yep, great.
Mega. So, the door split must be easier.
Yeah, yeah. That's right. Good for economics.
So, yeah, so I
and
mean,
that was baritone sax as well, starting at that time.
All right, so you just started the baritone.
Yeah, just moved it. Well, I'd had it for a bit, but I hadn't really been using it. And then, yeah, I got into more improvised music for some reason, I also felt I wanted to do that on baritone.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's funny because since I've known you, I've only known you to play bari.
Yeah.
And I've seen the occasional picture with an alto, and I was like, hang on, what's
yeah,
play that as well.
Well, like, there was a long time where I didn't play it at all, and then I have just in the past maybe about 1 year just started it again. I have another alto, and I had it for a bit, and then now it's been overhauled so you can actually play it.
Cool.
And I've taken it out on a few gigs, so now I'm using it sometimes.
Mega.
Yeah.
Nice. And then, all right. So, so after Guildhall, so. Was it around that time you met Dee Byrne?
Yeah, so it's funny, actually. We met and then we re-met a long time later. So we met in about 2006 in the Spitz, at the last night of the Spitz, which is a club in Spitalfields.
Yeah. Right, yeah, I heard about that. I don't think I ever went there, yeah. But
well, we only went there on that last night. Right. And so we were at this gig and before that, we'd met in a jam. That's why we met. I was just thinking, why would I have just randomly talked to her? But the reason is because when I first moved to London, I used to go to a jam in near Lambeth North Station.
All right.
And she was running the jam.
Oh, great. Cool.
And she was there. So I sort of met her as a random jam person, then re-met her at the Spitz, and we both were saying we want to do post-grad courses, but we hadn't done music degrees. Like, we're both saying that.
Right.
And then we weren't really in touch, you know, but actually we both went off and did that both at different places. And then when we re-met, we'd done it. And the reason we re-met was because I hit her up for a gig.
Oh, because she was running...
She was running the Jazz at the Waterline at that time.
Oh, okay.
Did you ever go there?
No, I think that must have been happening just before I moved here.
Okay, yeah.
Because when did I move here? I was here 2013, I moved here. So.
Yeah, so Jazz at the Waterline, I think... Well, actually, it wasn't long before. It might have been that year, because 2013 is when Loom started.
Right, yeah. And then,
but she was running a gig, and the venues kept closing, and she had to keep moving. So she had a few different venues, but she was doing like a weekly night, and I'd heard about it, and I was looking for gigs for the septet.
Right.
So I hit her up for a gig, and then it turned out to be this person that I'd met a few times before.
Oh,
and then we had a conversation about wanting to run gigs, and she lost that venue. She lost whatever venue it was at that time. And we had a drink at somewhere, and we were like, I think Dee said to me, do you want to run a gig together? And then, we ended up doing it.
So. Right. Yeah, yeah. Mm. So, yeah. But like Loom, because that was... Because it's still going.
Yeah,
so,
it's still
because you're playing this Saturday, aren't you?
Yep.
Barbican, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
But when it started though, so yeah, so the whole concept of that. So when
it started, it was a weekly gig in. We lost venues a lot as well. First, we were in the top of this pub called the 100 Crows Rising, and it was a really nice supportive venue. We're like, this is amazing. And then after about 3 weeks. They just said, oh, we're closing down.
Oh, no.
So we were like, oh. So then and we moved a few... Then we were kind of skipping around just venues because we had stuff booked in, you know, so we had to just find venues for different gigs. Then we were in a cafe called Long White Cloud in Hoxton.
Oh, yeah.
This was still weekly at that time. And we were here at the Vortex monthly at the same time. So that was a lot of gigs.
Running,
we were just doing stuff all the time.
That's brilliant,
That was our most active time. And, so like 2013, 2014, through 15, that's what we were doing. Tons and tons of gigs.
But I remember, long white cloud.
Yeah.
There was such a vibe there.
Yeah.
It was great.
Well, it was such a weird space, wasn't it? And they were really, really supportive of us. We were there for about 18 months.
Yeah,
which is not bad. But yeah, every time we went there, we had to move loads of tables. We had hang some curtains just to try and make like a gig space.
Yeah.
And it was this really long and thin room. It was quite challenging. As a physical space, but we were just like, we want a home where we can stay for more than like 2 weeks.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah. But no, because I remember, because where the stage was, depends on the size of the band.
Yeah, exactly.
You have to walk through the band to get in.
The door was behind the stage.
But that's cool though. I'm so into that. Like, what were the venues like? The Green Notes like that, I suppose, isn't it?
Yeah.
But I love that as a vibe, just like...
It was super small. Like, and like, intimate. We would have bands approach us and we have to really explain what the space was like.
Yeah.
It's like, it is really small. I remember in particular, do you know the band Shatner's Bassoon from Leeds?
When
they were a sextet, they wanted to come down because they were touring. And we really wanted to put them on, obviously. But it's like sending these emails like, guys, you know, this is a really, really small venue. Like sending a photo of like this tiny corner. And they're like, oh, yeah, no, it's fine. And I was just thinking, oh, no. Getting closer and closer to the gig. And it's six people, two drum kits.
Yeah.
This isn't going to work. But they arrived and it was like a sort of military operation. They just set it up and then they were all kind of installed behind the gear and they played great.
That's incredible. And they set up by...
They set up by the door. Yeah.
Wow.
But that's the one time I think we got noise complaints.
Cool. but not a great band though, aren't they?
Yeah, really.
Yeah. Actually, are they still playing?
I think they are.
Good. But great. So when Loom was at his busiest. So I guess you were starting off new projects then. So there's Word of Moth.
Oh yeah, that was a band which was a quartet with me and Dee.
Which
that happened like for a brief period. We did a few gigs at the Loom gigs, basically.
Oh, right, yeah.
And that's actually become a different band now because we ended up doing a gig in Switzerland where Loom was invited to go to a Swiss festival, which was really nice. And they wanted to put together a kind of collaborative thing between Swiss and UK musicians. So we took Seth and Johnny, Seth Bennett and Johnny Hunter over, and there were three Swiss musicians who the festival just like picked for the thing.
Oh wow.
And we did this like collaborative thing, and then that's actually now become a band, which is a sextet. So one person couldn't continue. The trumpet player is too busy to like commit to doing a band, but the other two guys were into it.
In fact,
the Swiss guy Simon Petermann, the trombone player, he's really running it now, and he organized a whole Swiss tour for it last year.
Wow.
And that's called Moonmot.
Cool, and there's a video online.
Yeah, there's a really nice video from the first gig, I think, and also now from the tour. And at the moment, Dee and Simon are working together on booking a UK tour and another Swiss tour for next spring. So that thing it's morphed into something. Yeah,
that's great.
It's really nice.
So, but I guess it was around that time you were starting to kind of get more into improv things.
Totally.
So through playing with Anton.
And then just, I don't know what else I was doing. I was probably doing more, random free plays and gigs and stuff. And then I was invited in 2014 by Jazz Northeast to go and play at the Gateshead International Jazz Festival in 2015. And they said, bring a new thing. And so I thought, this is the time to like pick my favourite improvisers that I've been coming across in the last year or whatever and make a band. And that's how Sloth Racket came about, which is my band now.
Yeah, yeah.
And I wasn't intending to start a new band at that time.
Yeah.
It was a one-off thing for that festival. But then we did it and we all thought, this is a band now. So then that just became my band. And the septet, I had to let it go because I can't have two bands.
Yeah, I'd imagine a lot of admin.
Yes.
It's a lot of people to do it. But all right, so it was Sloth Racket. So, you guys have been pretty prolific. Like, how many records have you put? Four?
It's done four, rounds? because 15, 16, 17, 18. No, that's not true. 16, 17, 18, 19. So it's four albums.
Wow.
And one live tape. Yeah, but I just decided that's what it's going to do because it's a nice way of like marking the state of it, like a record of what you're doing at that at that time and how the group's sounding. So I just thought, we're going to record this every year and we're going to tour every year. And that's what we've done.
Great. And then, so with the music that you write for that, mm-hmm. So you're doing standard notation, but have you been doing graphic scores as well?
Yeah, I've read. Exactly. Yeah. So when I had that initial gig, I wanted to bring in free improvisation to what I was doing, but I did still want to compose as well. So I thought, how can I make compositions that can be part of a free improvisation, basically? And I started experimenting with making graphic scores. I got my Pritt stick out, scissors,
cool. Okay.
Pens, and I made these scores. And they've changed over time. Every time we've done a new album with that band, I've changed our method a bit and experimented. And
right.
You know, I always know what everyone plays is going to be really good anyway. So
right,
you can push the boundaries a bit with experimenting with,
great, yeah,
with the scores. So there's some standard notation because I like to write riffs, and I think this is coming from my old listening, which is still my listening now as well.
But. Yeah.
So I write riffs, but also graphics sometimes, text stuff, and different elements basically.
Great. Yeah. Yeah, because I was listening to a bit of the latest record. Was it Dismantle Yourself?
Yeah.
Great title. Yeah. So, how would the process, well, like the stuff they've written for that record differ from the first one? So is it kind of a bit more reliant on, well, not reliant, but kind of a lot more improvising
later on it gets? The main thing that's changed since the first set of music is that instrumentation is not specified. So I think in the first batch of scores it would say like bass, you know, it would bass do this, saxes are doing that, drums do this, and most of the time that would, you would be in a set role kind of,
right?
Whereas now the material's there and it's kind of a free-for-all. Cool. Who does what? So yeah, I guess it's become more free in terms of like the roles of the players.
Cool. Yeah. But I guess because I guess you guys have been playing like loads as well. So I mean that would shape it in a certain way.
Yeah, totally. The group is, because we've been playing every year for 4 years or whatever, it evolves and we're a unit.
Yeah, that's burning.
We do our thing. Yeah. So yeah.
Great. And then I was gonna say, so with the making the CDs as well. So a couple of things I was gonna ask about this. So you do all your own sleeves?
I do.
As well.
Yeah.
That's incredible. I love that. Yeah. That's like ultimate DIY.
Yeah. I do lino cut printmaking. So I do the designs and I carve a block and then I roll out ink and I buy flat pack CD covers.
Okay.
And then I for a long time, would just use a wooden spoon to make rub on the back to make sure that the ink goes on the card. But then I've recently got a little mini printing press, so I've gone semi-automated now.
I feel
mixed about it. But that's because I was doing a crowdfunder at that time, and I had to do a massive batch of orders all at once, because the good thing about making your own sleeves is you don't have to hold loads of stock. So you can just go, okay, maybe I want to have 20 copies for this thing, and you just make those.
Yeah, that's
and then
good.
Everything else is just stored somewhere in its component parts. But for this crowdfunder, it was like, 60 orders. Okay, you know, they've all come in at once and they all needed to go at once, so I bought this mini printing press.
That's brilliant.
Made it a bit easier.
Because I bet a lot of us can sympathise with the idea of like the whole stock.
The stock under the bed situation, yeah.
I mean, like so many boxes of unsold CDs, which are available here, by the way.
Yeah, that's right.
But that's the thing, is it? It's like, hard to know how many to press.
That's it. And you can still overdo it. Like, I definitely still overdo it sometimes, like, especially for a tour, because you think, well, you know, probably going to sell this many per night. But what if we sell this many per night and you can really end up escalating and coming back with a few spares?
Yeah, but that's cool.
But that's better than, I don't know, I just think, I can't sell out.
Yeah.
But maybe that's what we want to do.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah. I guess you don't have to do the work for the next time you
exactly
sell them. But cool. And then, because we were chatting a bit off mic beforehand. So all your music is only available online through Bandcamp.
Yep.
So I guess, if we're like thinking about the whole streaming thing.
Mm.
What was it, a conscious decision to not do the streaming? Or was it just a natural thing that...
I mean, it's partly that it's a natural thing in the way Bandcamp works, I think, is really simple and nice, and it's obvious what the artist's cut is going to be. Well, I mean, it's the other way around. They're taking a small percentage, and it works really well for me. And especially now that they've got the Bandcamp app, I think you can listen to it.
Yeah, yeah.
In a streaming way, too. I mean, I'm pretty old school. I basically don't really interact with the world of streaming as a listener at
all.
That's
cool, though.
But Bandcamp does have that now, which is good. So I feel like I am at least vaguely... It is vaguely available for someone who wants to stream on their phone.
Totally. Because, I guess the tough thing with streaming is just like it's all available too easily, isn't it?
Yeah.
In a way.
There's nothing wrong with that in itself, but it's just about what's the situation with artists getting paid.
That's true, I was looking at those... Or is it streaming royalty calculator online, right? So is it at the moment? It's like half a penny you get from Apple Music. And I think it's less than the others. But it was the one that Jay-Z runs.
Oh, right.
Because he said, like, I'm going to do it properly for the musicians. And that's the one that pays the least. But it sounds better, though.
It sounds better. Oh, okay.
Which, I don't know.
Mm. It's cool. It's ups and downs, isn't it?
Yeah, it's tough to know, isn't it? But
I don't know. Like, I like the DIY ethos, and that's kind of how I like to do things. And Bandcamp fits with that for me. So
yeah, totally. Yeah,
I stay there, and I sort of vaguely keep an eye on what's going on streaming. And one day maybe I'll do it. But right now, I'm going to look into this Resonate platform actually.
Talk
about that.
Sure. Yeah. So what's that one?
Well, I need to do more research, but it's another streaming platform called Resonate. It's quite new, and it's got a different model in terms of like paying artists, and it's supposed to be better for artists. So
I
keep meaning to check it out.
Cool.
Yeah.
Brilliant. And then So to finish off, what have you got coming up? What's happening in the world of Kath Roberts next?
Yeah, well, Sloth Racket has just toured in September. We've just done that, and we've just released the album. So we're kind of in the phase of, like, dormant phase. I'm just booking stuff for next time. But coming up is a Loom gig, actually, on Saturday.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
At
so
the
that's
Barbican.
23rd.
Of November.
So I'll try and put this out before then.
Oh, yeah, because I wondered about this, but...
Hopefully, yeah.
But it's really nice because in 2015, Loom had a whole afternoon on the free stage of the Barbican for the festival, and that was a really fun thing. And so we've come back 4 years later, and we've got two sets, and I'm playing in a trio with Rachel Musson and Andrew Lyle, which is a new band, and we've been rehearsing a lot, and we've done one gig or two gigs, one gig.
So is all that compositions and stuff with that?
Well, and we have actually, we've played some compositions in the rehearsals, but then actually in the gig we did a free set, and I think we'll probably do that again on Saturday, and that's kind of where it's coming from. But we've experimented with like bringing material and stuff, so I don't know how it'll change over time. But
cool.
It's a really fun trio.
That's,
you have to like saxophones,
great lineup. I mean, the great lineup regardless, isn't it?
And then Dee's doing a set with Dima, which is her like duo with electronics.
This guy with
Merin Royard, who does the electronics, and then they're actually playing with Johnny Hunter, the drummer from Sloth Racket, and it's cool. The first time I think collaboration for
Brilliant.
them. So it's two trios, 5 o'clock at the Barbican foyer.
Great. And then are you playing later that evening as well?
I'm playing in Broccoli because I run a co-run at the moment, a series called Brock, with Colin Webster and Tom Ward. It's a residency, so it's much more more saxophones again, so three saxophone players.
That's
running.
That's great. I love saxophones. It's all good.
It's in a beer shop. And each time we do it, so it's sort of monthly, but it depends when we're free, so sometimes there's a longer gap if no one can. It's just like, when are the three people available? That's when the gig is. And then each time we each invite a guest, and so then there's three duo sets of free improv and some beers. So that's happening also on Saturday, and I'm going to play with Johnny. So after the Barbican, I'm going to run down and go to the beer shop.
Killer. That sounds like a great afternoon or great evening.
It's going to be nice, yeah.
Cool. But thanks for doing this, Kath.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, there's a big hand for Kath Roberts.
Thanks.
Big thanks to Kath for being the guest on the first ever live version of the Improvised Music Agenda podcast. And yeah, it was a fun talk. Great evening. So thank you for joining, and we'll see you next time. Bye.